It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to focus on the science of seeing, the complexity of the visual system, optics, eyes, color perception, pigments in art, and how the brain sees color, and anything else we can think of that would be interesting with light, color, and optics and seeing. With us today, we have three special guests. I want to welcome Carol Ann Carter, who is Professor Emeritus of Visual Arts from the University of Kansas. Hi, Carol Ann.
Hi, Mark.
Good to see you. And we have Robert Ryland, who's a retired physics teacher from the Shadyside Academy in Pittsburgh. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Mark.
And we also are honored to have Dr. Leslie Abrams-Tobe, who's an ophthalmologist in Indianapolis. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Mark.
So why don't we just start out with, I think the most thing that most people want to do understand is about how do we see? And I know there's multiple components to how we see, both physical and what the brain does. But Leslie, maybe that might be somewhere to start would be with you. How do actually we see things?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So, I think the easiest way to think about it is kind of following the path of light. So basically, you know, when we see an image, you know, light hits the eye. First the tear film and then the cornea, which is the clear dome over the colored part of the eye. Then it passes through the pupil and hits the lens of the eye, which, is a clear lens that sits behind the colored part of the eye. From there, it passes through what I usually describe as the jelly that fills the back cavity of the eye, the vitreous, and hits the retina. And from the retina, you know, there's a lot of different layers to the retina, but ultimately there's these things called photoreceptors. And the photoreceptors send a signal then to the nerve in the back of the eye. And that nerve runs from the back of the eye to the brain. It runs, you know, like I said, behind the eye. It actually crosses at one point called the optic chiasm. And then those same fibers, those nerve fibers, run through the brain to the visual cortex, which is actually in the back part of the brain. So that is, and then the brain interprets those images and that's how we see. So clinically, that's kind of the explanation I have of that.
Yeah, and Leslie, there's a real lens in there, right? I mean, it's flexible, but it really is a lens.
Yeah. So everyone has a crystalline lens in the eye unless you've had cataract surgery. So cataract is when the natural lens in the eye becomes cloudy, which happens to everybody at some point in their lives. And eventually then we go in and remove the natural lens and put in an artificial lens in its same place. So when we're young, it's clear. And then as we start to age, it not only kind of hardens, but also becomes cloudy. And that's when we call it a cataract.
Wow. And then I would assume the other thing is the musculature that we have around can modify that lens, its shape.
Yeah. So the way I describe it, you know, the lens, you can almost think of it like an M&M. It kind of sits in a shell or a bag. And that bag is connected to what we call the ciliary muscles by these little spokes, almost like a bike wheel. And those muscles can change shape, which can then change the shape of the lens. And that is part of what helps us to see.
Yeah, so it gives us the ability to focus or flex that lens a little bit for however is easy. Yeah, Carol Ann.
Are there analogies to camera lenses in this description at all?
Yeah, Bob.
Well, yes, they both use refraction, which is the bending of light when it goes from one surface to another. Like in a camera lens, it goes from air to glass and then through another surface in the glass and back to air And finally, the film or whatever electronic surface we use these days. But a camera lens is fixed in shape. So to adjust the focus, you change the distance from the lens to the focusing surface. Whereas as you've just heard with the human eye, it's changing the actual shape of the lens to change the focus.
Okay, good, thank you.
So that would make it, that would be really interesting because as you know, we as humans, we're trying to duplicate in robotics and other things the human thing, but I would think it'd be very difficult given technology to duplicate actually the human eye, the way that lens works. I would think we're still using, you know, camera lenses that move in and out for focus rather than in a robot. So it really doesn't have the flexibility of the human eye.
Okay.
Leslie, when I do that with my eye, I know that I can make it go out of focus. People do it all the time. Remember when those art paintings were around for a long time, you're supposed to defocus your eye and then you'd see something in it. But I know we can, as kids, we used to play with that, you know, trying to take our eye out of focus. But was there an evolutionary advantage to us being able to have a flexible eye?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure of the answer to that piece of things. I'm sure there is. You know, what's interesting about that, you know, what we were talking about with the lens and changing shape of the eye, that is what we call, you know, kind of accommodation. And that is what kind of explains presbyopia or the aging eye. Because when we're young, our eyes or the lens in the eye is flexible. And as we get older, it becomes more rigid. So that is why when we hit 40 to 45, we kind of lose that ability to focus up close without glasses. So that's really, you know, where that explanation comes into play clinically, is that that explains presbyopia or the need for reading glasses once we hit 40 or 45, because we lose the ability for that lens to change shape because it becomes more rigid as we age. So
yeah, and I would also think, Bob, in contrast to the camera lens, that the human eye is much faster at moving, but you know, between on focus.
Especially when you're young.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. So the second part of all this, and then I'm going to get into the art part here, Carol Ann. But the second part of that is that's how the mechanics of the eye work. So we have. Basically, we have a lens that we can control, focus passes through, we get receptors that pick up colors and light, we get that part, but it gets to the brain. And then we have a whole other thing that goes on. So anybody want to tackle that one? What's happening in the brain when we get to the brain?
It's not for me. My area of interest is around pigments. And how we see and use pigments, not light or the eye. But there is something about the question that I identify with, but I'll talk later about that.
Okay. So do we, Leslie?
So that's a good question. And you're asking kind of to explain what happens when it hits the brain. Is that correct?
Yeah.
For one thing, it's very complex. So, you know, there's lots of basically nerve fibers that make up the optic nerve. They part of it is the nasal part of our vision. Part of it is the temporal part of our vision. Some of those fibers cross, some do not. And then they, you know, there's this whole pathway through, you know, the brain. You know, once it hits the brain, I don't know if I can, explain it. I know that I do pretty well, but I don't know if I can put it into words at least. Yeah.
But as an ophthalmologist, you can correct the physical parts. I mean, that's what you're working on, right? That even back to the retina. But beyond that, how it's perceived is really a part of the brain. And I think I understand this right, Bob, but doesn't the eye also see like a regular lens, and that the image that's transmitted to the brain is upside down?
Yes, it is. In fact, there have been some interesting studies in which special lenses were fitted on subjects that reversed, did a second reversal so that the image was right side up on the retina. And after a period of accommodation, the people with those special lenses would see things normally.
So the brain could adjust back again.
The brain is very fluid in a lot of ways, yes. And as far as what we think we see in ways that we really don't, because the brain just isn't fast enough to create everything that we think we see. We're only seeing a very small part of an image at any time. And we have this illusion that we're seeing this whole range of things, but we're only focusing on a small part of it. And the brain helps us, you know, there's that evolutionary thing. The brain helps us figure out the things we need to, or our ancestors needed to survive. And that means that not everything works the way we think it does. And so there's lots of possibilities for optical illusions.
Oh, interesting. So not being able to see something that's right in front of your eyes, right? I mean, it sounds like a funny story, but it's true. So you can, there can be something right there, but you don't see it.
Yeah, and then there's the blind spot that we never notice. Unless you set up particular circumstances to show that there is a blind spot.
What's the blind spot, Leslie?
So the blind spot is, it's a part of our vision, you know, a part of our visual field that we can't see. It's small, and it's the spot that correlates with where the optic nerve inserts into the eye. And so everyone has a natural blind spot.
And that's where there's no receptors to speak of at that point.
Because that's where the optic nerve inserts. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where the brain comes in. It somehow maps through that. And
so
we really don't perceive it, which I know, you know, as part of aging, also a lot of that vitreous behind gets looser and you get what we call floaters, things there. But I know that when I'm concentrating on something and not thinking about that, my brain is mapping it away. The only time I really notice it is if I'm like trying to read a book and in a bright sunlight and I can see them moving and it's annoying, but I can actually go past that. So again, this is that brain thing that's so strange.
I always tell patients when they come in with new floaters, you know, so the jelly or the vitreous in the back of the eye liquefies as we age. And then, you know, some of that vitreous clumps together and you see the clumps of the vitreous. You know, at a certain point, it kind of pulls away and you get usually one big floater. And I always tell patients, you know, give it a couple months, the brain learns to ignore them. So,
yeah, it's so cool. So let's get closer to the art side. So we can see, we can focus, we get all that. How does the brain do color, or the eye do? What is it that allows us to see color, Leslie?
So, you know, in the retina, you have two different types of photoreceptors. You have rods and cones. The rods are for kind of black and white, more night vision. And then the cones, which are dense right in the central part of the retina or the macula, are what allows us to see color. So it's interesting, you know, that it's just a very small portion of the retina, but it's where you do the majority of your, you know, color and, you know, the most kind of important part of your vision from. So.
Wow. And Carol Ann, how does that then affect artists or art?
Well, several questions come to mind, of course, because I sort of travel around subjects very easily and sometimes get distracted, but I'm thinking about people who are colorblind, people who have limited vision, and people who have no vision, who then must move to feel, physical feeling, and or using other senses to see. And artists do the same thing. I mean, I'll just say this, that I taught for several years, and one of the things that students want to do right away is to play with colors, plural, not color per se, because they're not talking about relationships between colors or among colors. They want a visceral kind of experience with the material to create form. And a lot of it relates, I think, to childhood. We could play in the mud, we could play with colors. It was about playing with. It wasn't about learning what color does. And the learning about color comes when an instructor or someone intervenes and says, wait a minute, you're not working in color, you're just working with a bunch of colors. And so that's when the science and or the chemistry of color and color theory teaching comes in to play. It's not really of interest to students when they usually, when that's initiated, but it becomes interesting because they want to create a kind of form that's necessary where the necessity of learning what colors do together in composition can help them accomplish. But I was thinking about the whole notion of not being able to see and how students who, and again, this comes from my background in education and the things that teaching taught me. There are students who don't have vision. There are students who don't have limbs, but they can be considered artists. They don't need vision to be an artist. They don't need their hands or their fingers. And they're very sort of disciplined and interested in finding alternatives. So that aspect of color and or teaching has been a part of my my portfolio. I look at alternatives. So you're looking at, and I'm interested in this, you're looking at the practical, the physical, the practical aspects of what the eye's doing, how we do it. And it's really, really important. Most of us don't pay attention to that. Most of us just worry when it goes. Artists in the, and I was asked, we talked a little bit about what impact impressionism had on art. So maybe I could go there.
Yeah, sure.
Because you know, all you need to do is a Google skim of color and optics and art and just an enormous amount of information comes up. A lot of it starts with the Impressionists because they were rebels against traditional realistic portraiture or artwork. And most isms are a result of rebellion against the one that was previously considered the standard. And so they played around with, they were friends. They were in an era where optics and photography and chemistry were all sort of creating new standards. And there was a lot of discovery, and a lot of artists picked up on that and used photography as a way to jump off into playing with colors and optics. And the Impressionists were the ones who use tiny bits of color. And most people who appreciate art who are not artists, or many people, will look to the Impressionists because it feels very magical. You can get up close to a Monet and everything dissolves. Get far enough away and the image comes back into focus. So they played with vibrancy and light. And the traditionalists before them were very interested in physical structure, correct anatomy. They were also working with darker colors, and the Impressionists worked with vibrant colors, and they worked with colors as they played off of each other. And that was a big deal. And a lot of artists still work that way. What was I gonna say? There were the impressionists who started it. They were ridiculed, made fun of in the press. And then there were the post-impressionists who even went further in breaking up color and the whole color field. And the post-impressionist preceded the expressionist, who really broke almost all the rules and played with large blocks of color, like Cézanne, who was the father of modernism. He's considered the father of modernism. And I found a really appropriate quote, and it's from Manet, was a realist who hung out with impressionists. The primary reality of an artist is not what or the thing, but instead the way. And that is something I identify with. It's not what we're doing so much as how we're doing it. And so the impressionists sort of took liberties with how to do things and how to do it so that it was revolutionary. And another way of looking at that is just, it's not the thing, but the way. Instead the way. He said they said the canvas must be looked at, not through. That we were not looking through to a window to the outside where the perspective and distortion comes in. We're looking at the canvas. It needs to be looked at, not through. He wanted his art to rescue painting from the camera. In pure painting, there were brush strokes and color. There are brush strokes and colors themselves. They're patches themselves. Manet's techniques took hold among other artists, the Impressionists, and their subject matter became the strokes
So what's really interesting in all that you said, and this is kind of an interesting point, you've got several things coming together at the same time. Mm-hmm. You've got the more understanding from a scientific viewpoint.
Right.
There was also more understanding from a medical viewpoint.
Right.
Medicine was developing more. So, you know, correction of you know, with lenses was getting better. We could do a lot of things. We could test more, Leslie, for beginning to get the beginnings of that. And so that experimentation among artists is really interesting, as that kind of, there was this merger of this understanding of all of those, which I think is really interesting. We've been talking with Caroline Carter, Robert Ryland, and Dr. Leslie Abrams-Tobe about the art and science of seeing. And we'll join us again after this break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation about the science of seeing, the complexity of the visual system, optics and eyes. And we're looking at the ideas of how does aging affect our ability as an artist or as an individual to perceive not only color, but the world. And Leslie, I know earlier on, we talked a lot about how it affects our up close vision. But I know that there are other things of aging that are affecting us as well. And I'm sure it affected artists. Do you want to talk a little bit about what aging can do?
Yeah. So, there's a lot that, you know, the only risk factor of these certain things is age. So, you know, one of them I know we talked a little bit about already, which is cataracts, which is when the lens in the eye becomes cloudy, but not so much just cloudy, but the lens also becomes more yellow. The nuclear center part of the lens, you know, as time goes on, it becomes more yellow. So when I'm looking under the microscope, that's how I can tell if someone is developing a cataract, is kind of how yellow, or even, you know, if they go untreated for long enough, it almost becomes like, you know, brunescent orange, and even can be brown. And then eventually it can turn white to where the patient can't see. But that can definitely affect, you know, how an older person sees. For example, I do cataract surgery on, you know, this morning I was doing cataract surgery, and I had a patient, I was doing their second eye. And she actually said to me, you know, she was like, you know, you took the cataract out of my left eye and I cover my right eye and I can't believe that my blinds are white. She was like, over the past couple of years, I really thought they were yellow. you know, it can definitely affect how we perceive color because of that clouding lens. So that's one thing. You know, another thing that we see commonly as we get older is macular degeneration, which, you know, is a disease that affects the macula, which is part of the retina, the back surface of the eye. And, you know, as we get older, some people develop this. You get these little deposits in the retina called drusen. That's how it typically starts. And sometimes people will perceive that as kind of distortion. So straight lines will look wavy to them. So that's another way that, you know, the aging eye can affect how we perceive things.
And then I know also parts of the retina can be what we call, what you guys call latticing, but they can become kind of not as, I guess, dense, and sometimes holes can develop. And I know that can create problems too.
Yeah. So, you know, retinal holes or tears, although even more than that, within the spectrum of macular degeneration, among other diseases, diabetes can do this too. You can basically get atrophy or thinning of the retina with a lot of different disease processes, which, you know, just leaves less photoreceptors. And, you know, usually the visual acuity will drop and, you know, the vision will just be more blurry to a patient. And even it can become so atrophic or thin that they lose that central vision. So,
Leslie, I'm told I have a retinal hole in my left eye. And what caused me to have that checked was I would look at something like a TV image with my right eye and everything looked fine. And I would look at with my left eye and it was all magnified.
Okay.
And later with grid lines, I could see that they weren't parallel with my left eye.
I see. So was it a macular hole, which kind of affects right in the center? Is that, or was
yes.
it just,
right.
yeah. Yeah. And so sometimes they can repair that surgically. I don't know if it just depends on how bad it is, but that too can, the central vision, it can make it off from the other eye. Yeah.
So when we're talking about kind of clarification, we're talking about cataracts. We are talking about the lens of the eye.
Correct. Yeah.
So why do we use I don't know if you know this, but why do we use a different name? You know,
that, you know, I'm not sure the answer to that, but I explain that every day. Every day I say cataract is just when the natural lens becomes cloudy. Right. We call it a cataract. I have to look that up. I'm not sure.
I know. I'm curious too, because, you know, I had cataract surgery. No, you had lens surgery. It would help me understand better what you meant. But you're right. And when you do that and you're replacing that lens, it makes perfect sense, because that's before you have all that perception part. So before it hits the retina, where you actually are receiving the color and all that, it's going through something. So I guess you would liken it to, if I've done this before, but where driving glasses that have a yellow tint, because it's easier for me to see certain things on the road.
Yes. So
I guess in a way that's what your lens is doing, is getting a tint. It skews things.
Exactly. Yeah. Just less light can pass through, and the, you know, the light rays, they can become diffracted, and, you know, that affects how it hits the retina and how we see. So, yeah.
Yeah. And that's really a good explanation, because I've seen paintings of people who've had severe cataracts, and my wife's a veterinarian, and she sees all the time dogs that have it that are older, and they do have a white to their eye when you look at it. In other words, that lens becomes so cloudy that looking at their eye, their eye looks white.
Yeah. If it goes untreated, I know in more developing, you know, country, you'll see it more often than here, although I have plenty of them walk through the door too. So
That's really interesting. Bob, since there's that lens that's there, I'm curious about how then we came about being able to use optics to see further and to be able to correct and all that. Where did all that science of optics come in to helping the eye, even microscopes?
Well, I can't say for sure, but you can accidentally notice that with a drop of water, looking through that drop of water, you'll see distortions, and if things are just right, magnifications. The original microscopes, I think, were basically really small lenses that kind of mimicked that. So my guess is that it kind of started that way. And then with exploration, people found out a whole lot more about lenses and how they could work in combinations. So somebody invented a telescope. You know, I know more about telescopes. And this guy by the name of Galileo found out about it, but he didn't get the exact details. So he guessed. And he used a concave lens as the objective, which is backwards from the ideal, but it worked. He got it to work. It really narrowed the scope of vision, but he got it to work, and he built telescopes out of that. So there are a lot of accidents, people trying things and finding out what worked and what worked better. There's a problem with lenses. And that is that if you have a single material, the refraction refracts different colors of light by different amounts. So you get this color aberration, chromatic aberration. And so then they had to develop combinations of lenses that would reduce that. I'm not sure how the eye deals with that. I'd be interested in knowing more about that.
About like how glasses and, you know, how all that works. Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting, you know, people that they're, you know, most people are either nearsighted or farsighted. And nearsighted or myopic, basically what's going on there is people that are myopic or nearsighted, their eyes are longer than the average person. And so what happens is the light, when it, you know, where the light rays all meet, which is how we focus, that will actually be in front of the retina. So a negative powered lens basically directs those light rays so that they hit the retina. Versus a person that is farsighted or hyperopic, their eye is typically shorter. So the light rays converge behind the retina. So the plus powered lens will bring that convergence point to the retina. So that's how, you know, nearsighted and farsighted and glasses work for that.
Yeah, and probably people have seen as students some of the drawings of going through a lens, and it does come to a point, right? And that's where it crosses over and the image is inverted. That point is the what we call a focal point. And that's the point where we want it to be have the most focus. And so you're right, by adding another lens to your lens, right? Mm-hmm. You can change where that point of focus is, either out or in. And so when we have that weird thing in front of us, and there you're trying those all those different lenses, and you get to do the one, twos, and threes, whoever invented that. But we have that whole thing. It would be that in that case, what you're doing, you're really trying to move that point to the most optimal point.
That's exactly right. So you're trying different plus and minus powered lenses until you get it just right for the patient.
Right. Yep. And then that makes sense, Bob, from your viewpoint, what you were talking about, you're using combinations of lenses to correct for other things. So you may get one clear image somewhere, but then you have to add others to help clarify the entire image.
Yeah, when you get into really great magnifying power, telescopes or microscopes, there are real problems that have to be corrected for. The different kinds of aberrations can swamp the image that you're trying to produce and record. And there's a lot of work that's been done to get around that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it's interesting that our eye, again, until it ages compensates pretty well for all those aberrations. In combination with the brain, there's that kind of thing. I know a big area of sometimes controversy, sometimes not, Carol Ann, has been the idea that there were a fair amount of artists that actually used lenses and optics as a part of being able to draw something. They would actually, you know, project an image of something onto a canvas and trace the edges. And I think that's interesting use of optics, but people will call that, well, they were cheating. How would you describe that, cheating, or is that just using any other tool that an artist has?
It's a tool. It's just a tool. And it depends on the artist's approach, what the artist's intentions are. It's commonly practiced in classes where models are, where images are projected onto nude models, for instance, so that there's a pattern that's created by the juxtaposition of the simultaneous view of the model and the image. And the model can sometimes move around the image, and that's very commonplace. It's very common. The other thing we do is to ask a model, I've done this many times, ask a model to move in space like every 5 seconds and do a complete 360 over a short period of time and ask the students to draw that movement. That's also very common. In part two, it's very important for instructors to break the students' habits of trying to get everything precisely correct. So, which is what modernism, cubism, impressionism taught us. Generally in high school, students are, well, at least when I was in high school, we were asked to draw as representationally as possible. And when people talk about really important art, when many viewers will expect the art to be absolutely precise and realistic if it's going to be considered good. We turn that around so that closed eyes are common to some kind of sketching, in that you put an object in your pocket and your hand must feel that object and draw it with your eyes closed, or close your eyes to draw a tree, but feel it while you're drawing it. Having someone move through space very quickly gives you very abstract marks, but those are marks that have to do with expression and new art. The object, the goal is to expand on what the artist has in her toolbox.
Interesting. So I love that. I like the idea of it being a toolbox and the artist has ability to expand on it, just like the scientist had the ability to use lenses to expand on what the human eye was capable of seeing.
Absolutely.
The artist had that available. And so really that argument that you're cheating doesn't really
not a bit
at all fit, because we, you know, the paintbrush is a tool and we've had changes in paintbrushes down through the time. But the chemistry of what we use in the pigments and paints.
And what we use today in Photoshop, for instance, that was considered, or could be considered, cheating. In that it's easy to sort of pluck an image out of offline, use it in your work. That's cheating. It depends on how it's being used, not what, but how it's being used.
Right, if you're putting it up and saying, this is my original, that's a different thing than if I'm using it as a part of something that I am creating.
Exactly. One of the things that I enjoyed teaching very much was what I called kind of a systematic reduction of vision when looking at an image. Put a slide up when we were using slides, put a slide up and blur it like crazy so that you could hardly see anything that it represented. and then ask the students to draw that in a very sort of soft-eyed way and with soft pigments. Very grade composition. And then after maybe 10 or 15 minutes, 10 minutes, I'd say, to create more definition in the slide so that students could then become aware of what was going to happen toward the end, and a drawing on top of that blurred vision occurs. And then at the very end, there is often for me, a very, very highly sensitive drawing of the image that happened because it wasn't initially seen.
Interesting. Very interesting. Bob, were you going to say something?
No, I was just trying to follow along there. I did have some thoughts that...
Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about something else, not exactly the same as that, about looking at something with your eye squinting.
Yeah, same thing.
And sometimes seeing it better.
Absolutely. Seeing more definition, seeing more contrast, getting rid of all the extraneous parts around it.
Right.
That get in the way of describing what it is you're seeing.
Leslie, I would think in your field, one of those difficult things, and I think it's true of medicine in general, is getting a patient to really describe what they're seeing, right? I mean, they come in and I think something's wrong and they're trying to tell you from their perspective what it is. And I would think that in a way that's your own art form, is trying to wade through your experience to figure that out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, you know, sometimes one example is someone will say, look, there's a spot in my vision. So, you know, then you're trying to decipher, is this a floater? Does it move around? Is it stationary? Is this a problem in the retina? You know, is it a scar on the surface of the eye? And, you know, fortunately, a lot of what we do is visual. So, you know, the history is really important, you know, in order to determine, you know, where I focus my attention during the exam or further testing, but a lot of it we can see. So, which is what I like about what I do, is that it is so visual.
Yeah, you can look in there, and even if they can't describe exactly what it is, you can go, I see what's causing that.
Yeah. And if you don't see anything, then you might look towards the brain. So you do different.
Yeah, tests. And I would think occasionally that's something that happens, and then you have to refer to somebody like a neurologist. There's nothing wrong with the eye.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's something going on with the neuron space behind that.
Yeah, absolutely. Although there's tests, you know, we have a visual field machine, which basically can map the visual field of a patient. So yeah. Even if the eye looks normal and you're worried maybe that they had a stroke or something like that, you know, often we'll do that visual field test and you can pick up on patterns that match, you know, something going on in the brain and not the eye itself. So, which is pretty interesting.
Well, that's really fascinating to me. One last thing on that too, for all of you, I think what's interesting is for our eye, it's that we can move that around. And I think what really makes it amazing to me, and even without moving our head, our eyes move. But that movement of our eyes to seeing and focusing on different things was also, I think, an advantage to the artist. In other words, you could be looking at one thing thinking you're going to paint something, but see something out of your eye that you refocus on and you go, oh, I think that's better, even as a photograph. Is that true, Carol Ann?
Absolutely.
Kind of what an artist does. You're looking at one thing, but then all of a sudden you see something else.
That is in some ways the way artists will collect the sort of aesthetic data of the work they want to do, is to sort of go out and just skim or scan the environment. See what pops up. And I see a lot out of my peripheral vision that looks like one thing that it isn't. And it's more interesting to see what it feels like than what it actually is. So I'll sometimes not even look at what it really is. I'll just imagine or sketch what I think I'm seeing.
Wow, that's great.
Very, it's very common. Yeah. It's related to what the Impressionists were doing. They were thinking about, and the Expressionists, thinking about expression and freeing themselves from the requirement to do things a certain way, because that's not what artists do, and it's about the evolution of the art. So a lot of the work became very abstract. It was expressing something internal, not something external.
Right.
Or an interpretation of something.
Right. And that led to, you know, people going, I don't know what that is. Well, that's not necessarily important that they know what it is. How do you feel about it? And they were trying to evoke emotions, or they were trying to get a certain kind of, color wash to somebody's eye.
Exactly. So, Picasso was had a beautiful statement that I think still stands today. It's when people ask, what is it doing? What does it mean?
Yeah.
Don't ask birds what they're singing about.
I think that's a perfect thing.
You just
That's a good place to take another break. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with your friends and family any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the science of seeing. Bob, you were talking about creativity, and you were really coming off of what Carol Ann was talking about with artists, but you were equating it to science. You want to describe that to our listeners?
Yes. What Carol Ann was saying about artists noticing things that they weren't originally focused on, I think is kind of general, or there's an analogy that's general for creativity. In science, which I've studied, the history of science, those scientists who focus on finding out one thing sometimes do good work, but if they're too focused, they're going to miss a whole lot of things that come up as they are studying. So a little bit of peripheral vision, in effect, in science or anything else, any kind of investigation, can open up opportunities that you wouldn't have found otherwise. You see something that's happening on the side, and you realize that maybe that's more interesting than your original goal. It's the old idea of the journey, not the destination. So some focus is good, but too much focus and you miss a whole lot that you could learn from.
And Leslie, I know that that's true in medicine, that one of the real risks in medicine would be jumping somewhere too fast to focus on something when there may be more to see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A patient comes in with a complaint and, you know, maybe 95% of the time it's because of this one thing, but, you know, you really have to look at the whole picture. And in my case, you know, the whole eye and, you know, make sure you're not missing something, maybe it is that, you know, random 5% something different that, you know, could need attention. And that's, you know, with any patient too, that's why you have to, you know, really be careful in your exam every single time, because the eye really does, you know, it tells us more about people's overall health than I think people realize too. I mean, we can pick up, you know, sometimes diabetes in the eye that a patient may not know they have, melanoma can affect the eye. People don't realize that. So, you know, that's why at least once a year, you know, everyone should have a dilated exam so that we can, you know, pick up on those things and make sure we don't miss, you know, something that maybe the patient didn't come in for, but we find along the way.
Yeah. And I know that certain medicines can affect how you know, what people are seeing as well, which is why you always want to know what the medicines are that somebody's on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bob?
This reminds me of when I saw a optometrist who I believe had studied more extensively, and he said to me, you should have your thyroid examined. My eyes weren't tracking fast enough.
Oh, yeah.
He was right.
Yeah. Yeah, thyroid is another big one that affects the eyes as well. It's exactly, there's, you know, a number of things. So, yeah.
Yeah, so while we, and this gets to in art too, while we specialize, we still need to have that ability, that's that creative ability to be general. So we have to back up for a minute and say, there's a whole person or a whole landscape or a whole painting I'm looking at or a whole thing I'm studying. And we, also, we miss interesting things. Caroline?
Yeah, just, this is such a deep subject. I mean, we start with color, we go to medicine and this and the factual evidence there is within the discipline, and then there's how we get there. And again, that's where I live. There used to be, for me, a common little exercise that I'd use to ask to get students to think about how to approach their goal, because they are usually focused on the goal. I want to draw a tree, and I want to draw it really, really well. And we know what that means, so that it looks exactly like a tree. There's a 6-part creative process, and this is really old school. And it was something I learned from a psychiatrist back in the 70s. To start with identifying the project or the problem, which is for the eye, one thing, for the artist, another thing. I want to know what this tree feels like. To identify the project is the first piece. The second piece is to do your research. And the research for an artist could be to go to a museum, go outside, take a swim, whatever. The next piece would be to let that, let it bake in the oven, in your mental oven. And that means taking a nap, unfocusing on the goal, unfocusing on the project. And then after that is the shortest bit, which is the insight that comes. And the insight for what I'd call is like a cat. You can't chase a cat to make it do things. It's not a dog. And most students want to approach the insight as a dog to make it sit still and do what they want. But after that, after the insight and after the incubation, there is the production. And that production includes a lot of things that you see, that you've seen when you were not looking at the project. And that fulfills it, that fills it out. It expands on what the tree is or what it means. And you go into the production with more information. And then there's evaluation. And evaluation turns right back to re-identifying the problem, if you're a scientist or if you're an artist, because maybe you didn't think it through carefully enough, or you didn't do enough research.
Yeah, you know, that's really helpful, because that applies both in medicine, science, and the arts. Those same steps are, I'm sure, what Leslie goes through every time. You might go through them faster depending on your experience level, but sometimes if it's something that you haven't ever seen before, something really new that's puzzling, I like it if my doctor, or I like it if the scientist that's doing the research or the artist that's working on something takes a little bit of time. Yeah. Maybe I don't even get my answer right then. Maybe they have to go and then look up some stuff. I think those are really helpful tips to everybody to understand that, you know, the creative process isn't just this wham, there's something, you know, everybody thinks it's just like magical, it comes from somewhere, but you've been doing those steps maybe not systematically, but you have been doing them without you realizing it sometimes. And that's really amazing. I think one thing that we've kind of skipped over, and it's kind of important, and that's we see things in three dimensions, at least if we have two eyes. How does that work, Leslie? How do we see something three-dimensionally?
I got to think of how to answer this. Unless Bob, you have a better answer.
In the back of the brain.
Yeah.
But we do have two eyes, right?
Correct. So yeah, no, I'm trying to think how to explain it.
Well, you're thinking about that.
Yeah.
This is a real problem because the image is projected on a flat surface, essentially a flat surface, two flat surfaces. It is not possible to objectively create a three-dimensional image without some built-in assumptions that the brain supplies through evolution.
I was going to say, so yeah, you're still focusing it with two different eyes on two flat surfaces. I know we've all had the experience of covering one eye or the other. But the brain, I guess, Leslie, one way of helping might be is the brain is, I learned a long time ago that if I look through my camera for a long time to keep both eyes open, which a lot of people squint one eye, but you're actually better if you keep both open. But your brain is really good about blocking the one that is not the area of focus, right? I mean, it just keeps you from getting tired on, you know, if you're looking for a long time. And I know it's people that watch through microscopes, they don't. They use both eyes all the time, even though they can only see through one ocular. And so I would guess it has something to do with the juxtaposition of the two eyes that creates an illusion of these overlapping images.
Yeah, no, stereopsis is it's complex. You know, it's something we test. I mean, you know, clinically, it's because, you know, our eyes, as you know, most people with a normal eye, the muscles move in sync. So, you know, if you look to the left, both eyes are going to look left. If you look to the right, both are going to look right. Some people, you know, have, you know, problems with their, you know, the eye muscles and the eyes don't work in sync. We see it a lot in children where one eye tends to turn in or out. And so we test stereopsis on, you know, children quite a bit to see, you know, if that, you know, if they're worried about esotropia or the eye turning in or exotropia or the eye turning out, because they have reduced, you know, 3D vision because of that. But yeah, I mean, just, you know, the way that, you know, the visual fields work and, you know, the way the light hits the retina, that's, you know, with both eyes working in sync allows us to see, you know, by the time the signal hits the brain, we're seeing it. Right. So, yeah.
What I love about our conversations today have been, that, and our listeners are used to this, that we don't know all the answers and we have a lot to still learn, both about art and artists and scientists and in medicine, that all that is a part of the quest and part of the human ability is to be curious about the world and to make discoveries and to learn how to see in ways that are beyond just our eyes, but to really see. I want to thank both Carol Ann Carter, Robert Ryland, and Dr. Leslie Abrams for helping us explore how we see and perceive the world through our eyes. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.